Chapter 12. There entered a young gentleman in a riding dress, with his right arm in a sling, whereupon followed that pleasant confusion of laughing interjections, and handshakings, and "how are yous?" mingled with joyous short barks and wagging of tails on the part of the canine members of the family, which tells that the visitor is on the best terms with the visited. The young gentleman was Arthur Donnithorne, known in Islip, variously, as the young squire, the heir, and the captain. He was only a captain in the Loamshire militia, but to the Islip tenants he was more intensely a captain than all the young gentlemen of the same rank in His Majesty's regulars. He outshone them as the planet Jupiter outshines the Milky Way. If you want to know more particularly how he looked, call to your remembrance some tawny-whiskered, brown-locked, clear-complexioned young Englishman whom you have met with in a foreign town, and been proud of as a fellow countryman, well-washed, high-bred, white-handed, yet looking as if he could deliver well from the left shoulder and floor his man. I will not be so much of a tailor as to trouble your imagination with the difference of costume, and insist on the striped waistcoat, long-tailed coat, and low-top boots. Turning round to take a chair, Captain Donnithorne said, "But don't let me interrupt Joshua's business. He has something to say." "Humbly begging your honor's pardon," said Joshua, bowing low, "there was one thing I had to say to his reverence as other things had drove out o' my head." "Out with it, Joshua, quickly," said Mr. Irwin. "Belike, sir, you have been a-heared as Thias Beats dead drowned it this morning, or more like overnight, I the Willow Brook, again the bridge right I front o' the house." "Ah!" exclaimed both the gentlemen at once, as if they were a good deal interested in the information. "And Seth Beats been to me this morning, to say he wished me to tell your reverence as his brother Adam begged of you particular tea allow his father's grave to be dug by the white thorn, because his mother set her heart on it, on account of a dream as she had. And they'd ha' come fair souls to ask you, but they've so much to see after with the crowner, and that, and their mothers took on so, and wants them to make sure o' the spot for fear somebody else should take it. And if your reverence sees well and good, I'll send my boy to tell them, as soon as I get home, and that's why I make bold to trouble you Wyatt, his honor being present. To be sure, Joshua, to be sure, they shall have it. I'll ride round to Adam myself, and see him. Send your boy, however, to say they shall have the grave, lest anything should happen to detain me. And now, good morning, Joshua, go into the kitchen, and have some ale." "Poor old Thias," said Mr. Irwin, when Joshua was gone. "I'm afraid the drink helped the brook to drown him. I should have been glad for the load, to have been taken off my friend Adam's shoulders in a less painful way. That fine fellow has been propping up his father from ruin for the last 5 or 6 years. He's a regular trump, is Adam," said Captain Donnithorne. "When I was a little fellow, and Adam was a strapping lad of 15, and taught me carpentering, I used to think, if ever I was a rich sultan, I would make Adam my grand vizier. And I believe now he would bear the exaltation as well as any poor wise man in an eastern story. If ever I live to be a large acred man instead of a poor devil with a mortgaged allowance of pocket money, I'll have Adam for my right hand. He shall manage my woods for me, for he seems to have a better notion of those things than any man I ever met with. And I know he would make twice the money of them that my grandfather does, with that miserable old satchel to manage, who understands no more about timber than an old carp. I've mentioned the subject to my grandfather once or twice, but for some reason or other he has a dislike to Adam, and I can do nothing. But come, your reverence, are you for a ride with me? It's splendid out of doors now. We can go to Adam's together, if you like, but I want to call at the Hall Farm on my way, to look at the whelps Poyser is keeping for me. You must stay, and have lunch first, Arthur," said Mrs. Irwin. "It's nearly 2. Carol will bring it in directly." "I want to go to the Hall Farm too," said Mr. Irwin, to have another look at the little Methodist who is staying there. Joshua tells me she was preaching on the green last night.
Oh, by Jove,
said Captain Donathern, laughing. Hi, she looks as quiet as a mouse. There's something rather striking about her, though. I positively felt quite bashful the first time I saw her. She was sitting stooping over her sewing in the sunshine outside the house, when I rode up and called out, without noticing that she was a stranger, "Is Martin Poyser at home?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, I declare, when she got up and looked at me and just said, "He's in the house, I believe. I'll go and call him," apostrophe, I felt quite ashamed of having spoken so abruptly to her. She looked like St. Catherine in a Quaker dress. It's a type of face one rarely sees among our common people. "I should like to see the young woman, Dofa," said Mrs. Irwin. "Make her come here on some pretext or other. I don't know how I can manage that, Mother. It will hardly do for me to patronize a Methodist preacher, even if she would consent to be patronized by an idle shepherd, as Will Maskery calls me. You should have come in a little sooner, Arthur, to hear Joshua's denunciation of his neighbor Will Maskery. The old fellow wants me to excommunicate the wheelwright, and then deliver him over to the civil arm, that is to say, to your grandfather to be turned out of house and yard. If I chose to interfere in this business now, I might get up as pretty a story of hatred and persecution as the Methodists need desire to publish in the next number of their magazine. It wouldn't take me much trouble to persuade Chad Cranage and half a dozen other bull-headed fellows that they would be doing an acceptable service to the church by hunting Will Maskery out of the village with rope ends and pitchforks. And then, when I had furnished them with half a sovereign, to get gloriously drunk after their exertions, I should have put the climax to as pretty a farce as any of my brother clergy have set going in their parishes for the last 30 years. It is really insolent of the man, though, to call you an idle shepherd and a dumb dog," said Mrs. Irwin. "Should be inclined to check him a little there. You are too easy-tempered, Dofa." "Why, Mother, you don't think it would be a good way of sustaining my dignity to set about vindicating myself from the aspersions of Will Maskery? Besides, I'm not so sure that they are aspersions. I am a lazy fellow, and get terribly heavy in my saddle, not to mention that I'm always spending more than I can afford in bricks and mortar, so that I get savage at a lame beggar when he asks me for sixpence. Those poor lean cobblers, who think they can help to regenerate mankind by setting out to preach in the morning twilight before they begin their day's work, may well have a poor opinion of me. But come, let us have our luncheon. Isn't Kate coming to lunch?" "Miss Irwin told Bridget to take her lunch upstairs," said Carol. "She can't leave Miss Anne." "Oh, very well. Tell Bridget to say I'll go up and see Miss Anne presently." "You can use your right arm quite well now, Arthur," Mr. Irwin continued, observing that Captain Donathern had taken his arm out of the sling. "Yes, pretty well, but Godwin insists on my keeping it up constantly for some time to come. I hope I shall be able to get away to the regiment, though, in the beginning of August. It's a desperately dull business being shut up at the chase in the summer months, when one can neither hunt nor shoot, so as to make oneself pleasantly sleepy in the evening. However, we are to astonish the echoes on the 30th of July. My grandfather has given me carte blanche for once, and I promise you the entertainment shall be worthy of the occasion. The world will not see the grand epic of my majority twice. I think I shall have a lofty throne for you, Godmama, or rather two, one on the lawn and another in the ballroom, that you may sit and look down upon us like an Olympian goddess. I mean to bring out my best brocade that I wore at your christening 20 years ago," said Mrs. Irwin. "H, I think I shall see your poor mother flitting about in her white dress, which looked to me almost like a shroud that very day. And it was her shroud only 3 months after, and your little cap and christening dress were buried with her too. S. He had set her heart on that, sweet soul. Thank God you take after your mother's family, Arthur. If you had been a puny, wiry, yellow baby, I wouldn't have stood godmother to you. I should have been sure you would turn out a Donathan. But you were such a broad-faced, broad-chested, loud-screaming rascal, I knew you were every inch of you a Tragedy. But you might have been a little too hasty there, mother, said Mr. Irwin, smiling. Aunt, you remember how it was with Juno's last pups? One of them was the very image of its mother, but it had two or three of its father's tricks notwithstanding. Nature is clever enough to cheat even you, mother. Nonsense, child. Nature never makes a ferret in the shape of a mastiff. You will never persuade me that I can't tell what men are by their outsides. If I don't like a man's looks, depend upon it, I shall never like him. I don't want to know people that look ugly and disagreeable, any more than I want to taste dishes that look disagreeable. If they make me shudder at the first glance, I say, take them away. An ugly, piggish, or fishy eye now makes me feel quite ill. It's like a bad smell. Talking of eyes, said Captain Donathan, that reminds me that I've got a book I meant to bring you, Godmama. It came down in a parcel from London the other day. I know you are fond of queer, wizard-like stories. It's a volume of poems, lyrical ballads. Apostrophe, most of them seem to be twaddling stuff, but the first is in a different style. The Ancient Mariner is the title. I can hardly make head or tail of it as a story, but it's a strange, striking thing. I'll send it over to you. And there are some other books that you may like to see, Irwin, pamphlets about antinomianism and evangelicalism, whatever they may be. I can't think what the fellow means by sending such things to me. I've written to him to desire that from henceforth he will send me no book or pamphlet on anything that ends in ism. Well, I don't know that I'm very fond of isms myself, but I may as well look at the pamphlets. They let one see what is going on. I've a little matter to attend to, Arthur, continued Mr. Irwin, rising to leave the room, and then I shall be ready to set out with you. The little matter that Mr. Irwin had to attend to took him up the old stone staircase part of the house, was very old, and made him pause before a door at which he knocked gently. Come in, said a woman's voice, and he entered a room so darkened by blinds and curtains that Miss Kate, the thin middle-aged lady standing by the bedside, would not have had light enough for any other sort of work than the knitting which lay on the little table near her. But at present she was doing what required only the dimmest light spawning the aching head that lay on the pillow with fresh vinegar. It was a small face, that of the poor sufferer. Perhaps it had once been pretty, but now it was worn and sallow. Miss Kate came towards her brother and whispered, "Don't speak to her. She can't bear to be spoken to today." Anne's eyes were closed, and her brow contracted, as if from intense pain. Mr. Irwin went to the bedside, and took up one of the delicate hands and kissed it. A slight pressure from the small fingers told him that it was worth while to have come upstairs for the sake of doing that. He lingered a moment, looking at her, and then turned away, and left the room, treading very gently. He had taken off his boots and put on slippers, before he came upstairs. Whoever remembers how many things he has declined to do even for himself, rather than have the trouble of putting on or taking off his boots, will not think this last detail insignificant. And Mr. Irwin's sisters, as any person of family within 10 miles of Broxton could have testified, were such stupid, uninteresting women. It was quite a pity handsome, clever Mrs. Irwin should have had such commonplace daughters. That fine old lady herself was worth driving 10 miles to see, any day. Her beauty, her well-preserved faculties, and her old-fashioned dignity made her a graceful subject for conversation in turn with the king's health, the sweet new patterns in cotton dresses, the news from Egypt, and Lord Dacey's lawsuit, which was fretting poor Lady Dacey to death. But no one ever thought of mentioning the Miss Irwins, except the poor people in Broxton Village, who regarded them as deep in the science of medicine, and spoke of them vaguely as the gentlefolks. If anyone had asked old Job Dumelo who gave him his flannel jacket, he would have answered, "The gentle folks, last winter." And Widow Steen dwelt much on the virtues of the tough the gentle folks gave her for her cough. Under this name, too, they were used with great effect as a means of taming refractory children, so that at the sight of poor Miss Anne's sallow face, several small urchins had a terrified sense that she was cognizant of all their worst misdemeanors, and knew the precise number of stones with which they had intended to hit Farmer Britton's ducks. But for all who saw them through a less mythical medium, the Miss Irwins were quite superfluous existences in artistic figures crowding the canvas of life without adequate effect. Miss Anne, indeed, if her chronic headaches could have been accounted for by a pathetic story of disappointed love, might have had some romantic interest attached to her. But no such story had either been known or invented concerning her, and the general impression was quite in accordance with the fact that both the sisters were old maids for the prosaic reason that they had never received an eligible offer. Nevertheless, to speak paradoxically, the existence of insignificant people has very important consequences in the world. It can be shown to affect the price of bread and the rate of wages, to call forth many evil tempers from the selfish, and many heroisms from the sympathetic, and, in other ways, to play no small part in the tragedy of life. And if that handsome, generous-blooded clergyman, the Rev. Adolphus Irwin, had not had these two hopelessly maiden sisters, his lot would have been shaped quite differently. He would very likely have taken a comely wife in his youth, and now, when his hair was getting gray under the powder, would have had tall sons and blooming daughters such possessions, in short, as men commonly think, will repay them for all the labor they take under the sun. As it was, having with all his three livings no more than 700 a year, and seeing no way of keeping his splendid mother and his sickly sister, not to reckon a second sister, who was usually spoken of without any adjective, in such ladylike ease as became their birth and habits, and at the same time providing for a family of his own, he remained, you see, at the age of 48, a bachelor, not making any merit of that renunciation, but saying laughingly, if anyone alluded to it, that he made it an excuse for many indulgences which a wife would never have allowed him. And perhaps he was the only person in the world who did not think his sisters uninteresting and superfluous. For his was one of those large-hearted, sweet-blooded natures that never know a narrow or a grudging thought. Epicurean, if you will, with no enthusiasm, no self-scorching sense of duty, but yet, as you have seen, of a sufficiently subtle moral fiber to have an unwearying tenderness for obscure and monotonous suffering. It was his large-hearted indulgence that made him ignore his mother's hardness towards her daughters, which was the more striking from its contrast with her doting fondness towards himself. He held it no virtue to frown at irremediable faults. See the difference between the impression a man makes on you when you walk by his side in familiar talk, or look at him in his home. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.